as a kind of reward. How's the sound?
Is it jarring? Yes.
Oh, I'm. That was my bad. Okay. So to appreciate people coming back in a timely way from lunch, is there a question or two we could just take or comment, and then we'll get back on our more formal track? Great.
Sure.
Throbbing, kind of clay ball. And I'm wondering what's happening in the brain. And it's typically, I only see it when I'm really, really dropped in. So I'm wondering if that is like
a do you have a positive? So she's.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, she sees when she's in a deeper state, she has a visual phenomenon that arises. Of a kind of blue ball that has an association of positive emotion to it. Yeah. You're going to say something?
Yeah, that there is in all of our sensory systems basically exist in a kind of sort of a standard state. They sort of idle at about at a certain rate, and the sensory input when you're looking, say, if you're looking at me, your visual cortex has got all kinds of light lines and dark lines and slide behind me and stuff on the ceiling and stuff on the floor. And so there's all this stimulus. When you close your eyes, your occipital lobes no longer have all that stimulation. And so when you're in a deep state of concentration, what you're actually, what's probably actually happening at that time is that you're aware of the visual idling frequency of the occipital lobes of your brain. Okay? Ajahn Sumedho in his gives a talk on what he calls the nada sound, N-A-D-A, which is the little high-pitched hum that is always there in your auditory experience. And at the risk of giving everybody tinnitus, I'll talk about it. But it's the same idea. It's that. The cochlear nucleus, the neurons that are taking vibratory energy and turning it into electrical signals, those nuclei are firing at a particular rate. And then, as the sound comes in, some of those neurons will fire at a higher rate. Some of them will fire with at a lower. The net input of that is the frequency of whatever sound you're listening to. Okay, the same thing's happening in the visual cortex, and. I once did a meditation when Ajahn Sumedho talked about that. You can actually take and find that same electrical space in smell, taste, in body awareness. Each of those will have their own kind of frequency. And if you actually get really, really quiet, you can find the one of the mind, which is actually a very high-pitched, very fast thing. So all of that's available. The net out is not that this is any that this is any experience to chase in and of itself. It is just an example of this is the electrical dance that your brain is in at that moment, and concentration can allow you the rest of the inputs to go away enough that you can be cognizant and aware of it.
So is it kind of like the baseline?
Yeah. It's a little bit like, unless you have a Prius like me, in which case you don't have something like this when you come up to an intersection. But if you have a standard gasoline engine car, it's got an idle. It's turning over at 600 to 800 RPM, and most of the time we don't pay attention to it till you get into somebody's Prius and the engine stops when you come to the stop sign. You go, hey, wait a minute, turn it on.
Let's keep. Okay, great. Thank you. We'll keep going. Thank you. So, here we have a roadmap from the Buddha. This is yours.
Okay, so this is going to set up our next meditation exercise. And basically, as Rick was talking about when we broke for lunch, we'd like to have this sort of build and build and build. So starting from a sense of panoramic awareness and a little bit of, and a sense of, to whatever it's ever come back for lunch, I know I went for a fast walk, and somebody said, boy, you're doing one of the fastest walking meditations ever. I said, deep concentration. Yeah, right. I was trying to get a touch exercise in. So to whatever extent, that same level of quiet and depth that I was feeling in the room when Rick was finishing up the meditation just before lunch, bringing that back into the room now, and using it to go deeper into this sense of the factors of attention and concentration. And in the terms of developing right concentration, the Buddha laid out his particular map in which the mind is steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Now, steadiness of mind, attention is stable. In the first couple of times we've given our Neurology of Awakening talk, we broke this out a little bit. But the short version of this, think of your mind as the metaphor would be as an ice skater. When you're shifting from the left foot to the blade on the left foot to the blade on the right foot, you apply the blade to the ice. That is applying attention. And then you glide on that blade, which is sustaining attention. And that factor of being able to, with your attention on the breath or whatever object of meditation you have, that factor of being able to sustain and hold and continue long beyond the 10 seconds where your brain is going to start bringing something else up and, you know, and disrupt the disrupt your concentration with some, you know, some new laundry list or shopping list that you're going to have to go figure at the end of the day. So developing steadiness with a very stable attention. And when you, if you find that your attention's been taken off, once again, coming back, apply, go to the left foot. Take that blade, apply and sustain. Or apply and sustain. And so you glide through, the idea is sort of to be able to take your attention and glide through your meditation on it. It's a very stable kind of idea. The second aspect of the roadmap is a sense of quiet. Here we're talking about a sense of tranquility, a sense as you continue to go through your meditations, of very little verbal or emotional static, minimal sensory motor stimuli, a little goal-directedness, just enough to say keep you on the attention to the object of meditation. Another metaphor to use is, you know, it is like a still pond with a few waves, and being the pond, not the waves on top of it. So you're the still pond or the very deep ocean, and all the other stuff is just happening on the surface, and currents are moving, but the deep ocean rests, you know, in the bottom. You'll notice in the meditation experience from the seated place that if you're seated for a while and you close your eyes, visual cortex will drop, visual stimuli drops away almost immediately. For the most part, auditory stimulus is about the second most salient stimulus in our hierarchy of stimulus things that we pay attention to. Smell and taste are kind of not there. But if you go into the physical manifestation of the seated posture, the body drops away, right? You have that experience. All of a sudden, you know, without really drawing attention to it, as long as nothing is in pain, your awareness of the body drops off. And all of a sudden, you don't have physical stimuli from wiggling around on the seat and getting, you know, stimulus to my legs from the chair and, you know, wiggliness from my arms and motion sensors in my elbow telling me I'm moving my arms. All of that becomes very, very quiet. And it's part of getting rid of some of the distractions. So quiet. The third part of the roadmap is this singleness. As you proceed through steadiness and quiet, Many times the experience then is that there's a very integrative awareness, that there's minimal thought, that there's a deep and nearly effortless engagement with the target of attention. Rick has sometimes talked about that when he can get to this state in his meditation, it's a little bit like the breath is a rocking chair. You're just sitting in the rocking chair. And you're with the rocking chair and with the rocking chair. And there's nothing you really have to do except continue to just be with the rocking chair. And so in this singleness, there's a very sense of great collectedness. There's an integrative, sort of inclusive awareness. Everything being all one percept, that panoramic view, that sort of the breath, that the entire body breathing is a unit idea. And there's kind of a ka-chunk when this happens, that it's all of a sudden everything just falls into one. You're very much absorbed in the object of attention. You're withdrawn from almost everything else. Wispy, maybe peripheral thoughts will happen as you achieve this level of concentration. And there's this growing equanimity, this sort of impartiality toward experience. It is not indifference. It's not like I don't care about what's happening. It's that, oh, that's happening. And one of the major errors that people oftentimes make in terms of understanding what equanimity means is that equanimity is not indifference. Indifference contains within it anger. Equanimity does not contain anger. Equanimity is this is good and that is also good, no matter what it is. And there's very little sense of self. Breathing is happening without a breather. I always like this piece because, you know, almost all spiritual traditions, when they talk about, including anything that's described as spiritus, which is the Latin for breath, all of them focus on the breathing. And as you think about it, it's one of the few autonomic functions you have over which you have volitional control. I'm exercising volitional control right now in talking to you. But ultimately, I have no volitional control over breathing. I'm going to take that next breath until I die, or until I turn blue in front of you, which since I was 2 years old, I promised I wouldn't do. But this breathing without a breather, to have that ability that all of a sudden the breath is just what is happening. And there's no longer the sense of having to focus on the breath. There's no longer a sense of having to initiate the breath. You're just breathing. Breathing is here.
If I could just add 2 points. You know, in daily practice, particularly if a person has either a great sort of talent for meditation,
right,
or some amount of practice with it, this place, singleness of mind, I think is quite attainable, particularly toward the end of a daily sitting, particularly a daily sitting that has some length to it, you know, 30 minutes, 45 minutes perhaps. It's that said, singleness of mind, as you saw in the Buddha's ordering, you know, the mind is steadied internally, quieted, and brought to singleness. It's the third step in a process that's quite profound. So it may not come right away, but it is quite attainable.
Right.
The second thing to say about it, and also I should add about the first point, that we will sometimes experience this kind of singleness for a few seconds, or maybe a minute or two, and then something else will take our awareness away from it. And then sometimes, even at home, it can stabilize and last much longer. And even for some people, they fairly quickly drop into this place, even at the start of their meditation, and just kind of hang out there. For me, honestly, you know, someone who's meditated quite a long time, if I'm at home and my mind is distracted, it'll take a while for the sediments to settle, you know, 10, 15 minutes, whatever. But then increasingly, this starts to become more and more of kind of home. You know, I think that's realistic. Okay. The second point is that singleness of mind, and you'll see this singleness of mind showing up again as the fifth jhana factor. This is, if you've ever heard the term ekagata, you know, singleness of mind, unification of awareness. And it's the tipping point into the jhanas. And so getting clear about what this state is like and how is very useful. That's part of what we're doing here. I should say this as almost like a overarching principle.
Right.
is to get clear what each one of these places feels like so you can leave a trail of breadcrumbs and find your way back to it again. What does it feel like for the mind to be steadied internally? What does quiet feel like? Rick's going to lead us in a guided practice in a moment about quieting the mind. Right? What does a quieter mind feel like? And then last, what does singleness of mind feel like? And then later on, we'll get into the different jhana factors and besides this one and what they feel like. So it's useful to form a kind of differentiated sense of what key different experiences are. We think that the yogic traditions that the Buddha was arose out of and then his own teachings and additions to them pointed to certain key states of mind that are building blocks to a growing liberation and a growing depth, if you will. And these great yogis and practitioners came across these experiential, psychological, mental states as building blocks because they map to underlying neurology that increasingly takes us further and further into the deep end of the pool. The linking or the mapping of these mental states to the underlying neurology is just beginning. Rick and I have been trying to do good, plausible first drafts of that, but that's the basic idea. So in your own practice, it can really help to, you know what it feels like, to register it as an experience when you drop into one of these places. Okay, great.
Okay.
And then
the fourth part of the roadmap is concentrated. And this is after establishing, as Rick was saying, steady, quiet, and single. One develops a profound absorption in what's actually a non-ordinary state of consciousness. The formed jhanas, which are the first four that we have, the slide that we showed you earlier. And then the formless jhanas leading through via samadhi into mystical transport and all the way to nibbana. And this, again, is one of the consistent litanies of the within the Dharma, where it is that thing which born of seclusion and joy and rapture and giving things up and finally, through neither pain nor perception, and then there's through perception and non-perception, and there's all kinds of stuff that happens as one attains these very, very deep states of concentration. And in this concentration, interestingly enough, there is a pervading sense of rapture, bliss, happiness, contentment, tranquility, equanimity. Our roadmap for this is that you're talking about alteration in neurotransmitter states, in particularly dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, perhaps oxytocin. Rapture, probably the best, rapture bliss, probably the best neurotransmitter to map to that is dopamine. I mean, that's that luscious reward chemical that gets stimulated when a really good thing happens. Chocolate probably does that.
Yes.
There is also in another state of sort of a brightening of the mind, which is part, I think, of bliss and happiness. That brightening is norepinephrine. That's what a norepinephrine surge feels like. Look at that. It's that aha, wow experience. The tranquility, equanimity probably maps most potently to serotonin as the major neurotransmitter that's most likely to be involved in that particular kind of phrase. Now, these are all phrases that are translated out of the Pali Canon, and we're just now beginning to start to translate those into neurophysiology and neurochemistry. And then as one gets concentrated, there's this sort of penetrating clarity into the fine-grained details of experience. You can watch sound arrive before it is perceived as anything. What was that sound that just went on before I labeled it the heater fan? Okay. What is the sound of my voice and its various qualities of the sound of my voice? The pitch, the timbre, the slight hoarseness and all the rest of that. What is that before the words show up as something that you understand? And it gets down into these fine-grained details when one's mind is very quiet. One of the other pieces I should talk about here is that, you know, I've mentioned a little concept called mind moment earlier on today. And these are little periods of when the brain is kind of all functioning on, this is the thing that's happening right now, and then it moves on to the next one and the next one. Mind moments in the brain varying, which have been studied using EEG coherence techniques, mind moments are somewhere around 20 to 100 milliseconds long, and you can see these. Well, 20 millisecond mind moments means that you have 50 per second. 100 millisecond mind moments means that you have 10. If you think about going into a very stressful experience, say like a car accident or something, and all of a sudden you go, oh, I remember every detail of that. What's happened is that because of the stress of the threat experience, your mind downshifted from 100 millisecond mind moments that it was kind of driving along being bored to 20 millisecond mind moments when it's processing very, very quickly and stores each one of those mind moments as a discrete memory point. Look at this fine grain details and clarity and say that, okay, when you get very, very quiet, you begin to literally perceive very, very short mind moments very discreetly. And interestingly enough, the period between the mind moments when actually electrical chaos is present and the brain is not organized and is not coalesced and is not coherent. So you begin to be able to see that as opposed to a nice, smooth, industrial light and magic movie, you've got Charlie Chaplin flicks with lots of graininess and flicker. And you begin to see that, you know, this is just a Charlie Chaplin movie with a lot of flicker to it. Okay. So let's move into a little practice on this one. So I will try, because of the nature of this, to keep what I say to a minimum. So take up your seat or your stance or you're lying down, whatever position you choose for this meditation. And take three deep breaths, to let go of all the busyness of the lunch period, to let go of all the stress of arrival, to let go of listening to the talk of the last 15 minutes. And come into a relaxed and quiet, receptive state. Let your eyes gently close or remain slightly open. And for this meditation, bring your attention to the breath. Initially, let your attention on the breath be at the opening of the nostrils, just above the upper lip. Gradually let your awareness of the breath expand outward through the body, to feel the whole body breathing. At the end of each breath, apply your attention to the breath. And then sustain your attention throughout the breath. Apply and sustain. Apply and sustain. Letting all thoughts and feelings coming into awareness other than the breath vanish back into the emptiness from which they came. And now deep within the breath, feel the quiet. Feel the depth of the pool of awareness. Deep and calm. Undisturbed by little wavelets of language. Undisturbed by memory. Undisturbed by visions or other sensations. That all comes and goes. But the deep, quiet, clear pool remains. And now with this stable attention and quiet mind, and the whole body breathing, watch how things seem to be happening as one percept. Everything incorporated in breathing. Down deep in the pool, withdrawn from almost everything else, all sensations, sight and sound and smell, taste, touch, just happening in the breathing. Things arise. Stay a while, pass away. The pool remains. This is just as it is. For just this moment, and then it will pass on. The breathing remains. Perhaps allow a sense of rapture in the breath to arise. Joy in the breathing. Bliss of this tranquil, deep pool of awareness. Letting yourself become more and more absorbed in the breath. And from this place of oneness with the breath, watch the next thought appear. Watch it bubble up and take shape and form. Watch it vanish and leave no trace. And the next one. And the next. Who is being thought by this breathing? No one. Just something else to let go. Probably presumptuous, but a little quick dip in the jhana pool. So, any questions about that particular practice? I sort of fused that with the one we had just before lunch, but yeah.
Is it similar or different to quietly falling asleep?
That's a tough question to ask after lunch. There's been a lot of discussion over years and years and years about meditation and sleep and whether this is some variant of. The neurophysiology and the imaging of meditators is not at all similar to the neurophysiology and the imaging of patients who are falling asleep. The electrical signals are different, the neurotransmitters are different. A lot of times, I know from my own state, as I was beginning to learn to meditate, and even now if I'm tired, it's very difficult for me to hold the tension between being very internally quiet and relaxed and drifting off. And sometimes I have to awaken myself from sort of that ruminative, early slow wave sleep kind of dreamy state that shows up. This is somewhat more focused than that. Sure. The first and second meditations, you mean Rick's meditation before lunch and mine after. The intention of the first meditation was to get away from the I, me, mine focus and was to move into the lateral networks, which were more about processing what the lateral networks do is they process contact of various kinds, auditory contact, somatosensory contact, and they move away from the story of this is my bowl. Well, it's not Spirit's rock bowl. So this was to move you away from that I mean mine. The little interesting piece in the slide set we showed in the morning is that the anterior cingulate is also a mesial structure. And we pointed to that slide earlier in the day and said, this is a meditator deep in meditation, and this is the anterior cingulate, which is a midline structure. And we're trying to differentiate the will and intention, I, me, mine, from the sensory processing, I, me, mine, and leave you just with the am I on task or off task. One of those techniques is to move you out, which is to get into the lateral networks and to see things most as kind of a holistic piece. And the other, which is more this meditation, is really to quiet all that stuff, drop all that away, and come in just to staying on the task of that which you have decided is the focus of your meditation for that moment. You know, you can meditate on a bowl or breath or whatever, but that is the am I on task or off task? Have I applied attention? Am I sustaining attention? And then letting things drop away. So that's sort of the distinguishing feature. And how you would use those would be dependent upon a sense where you are at the beginning of the meditation. To some extent, your intention for the next meditation period has to be based on my state sitting down. As I sit down to meditate, how do I feel like? Am I distracted? Am I emotionally upset at something? Is it a lovely fine morning and I'm in a great space? Depending upon all of those causes and circumstances, all that condition and circumstance, that whole interdependent origination of this moment which I decide to sit down, I may need to select a particular technique to help me in what my ultimate task is, which is liberation from being entrapped by this moment and this mind of mine. Did that make that answer? Yeah.
I do a lot of hypnosis in my practice, and one thing I find is sometimes patients will say, oh, I was asleep. But at the end of it, when I say, okay, you can start to reorient yourself, and I'm speaking very quietly, and I'm saying you can begin to reorient yourself to the room, slowly begin to open your eyes, and they do. And so then they say, I think I was sleeping. But I always find it interesting because if you were sleeping and someone's talking to you very quietly all along, why at that particular moment would you start to reorient and open your
right.
eyes?
Right. I'm gonna repeat that, if I may. Tell me if I'm incorrect. She does a lot of hypnosis work as a caregiver clinician, I would presume. And she, the clients after their hypnotic experience will report having been asleep. But yet, during the hypnotic experience, she's able, say, for example, even though she's talking in a very quiet voice, to say, it's now time for you to reorient to the room. It is time for you to come back from the experience, to bring back with you whatever you're going to have learned from that experience. And the client is able to do that even though their self-report is of having been asleep. I think there's a very little interesting trick in here, which is the relationship of memory to sleep and memory to hypnotic states, and whether we retain that information into the next mind moment. We're very, very aware that when we go to sleep, we're amnestic. We have billions upon billions of thoughts between 10 o'clock at night when you lie down and 6 o'clock in the morning when you get up. You have lots of incredibly vivid dreams. You know, you have psychotic experiences up the yin-yang in your sleep states. We know because we wake people up after rapid eye movement sleep and say, what were you dreaming about? And I was flying through the air with a lightsaber stabbing my grandmother for messing up on my peanut butter. Huh?
Not everyone has dreams like that, right?
I'm fine. That was last night. So we have these tremendous mental experiences during one third of your life for which we are completely amnestic. And it's quite interesting that we have this forgettery in addition to our memory. We have a forgettery that scrubs all that stuff clean, so the next morning you may be left with a little emotional residual of what you went through in your dream states last night, but you by the most part don't remember that about hour and a half to 2 hours of rapid eye movement dreaming sleep where you had all kinds of vivid experiences. And it's important for us as central nervous systems and as humans to do that because you deprive people of REM sleep and they go psychotic within 72 to 96 hours. I mean, it is not a process that we can do without. So there's something very interesting here about sleep and altered states of concentration and our statement retrospectoscopically, I was asleep, when actually you may not have been. And so it's entering into this boundary zone where we're not necessarily employing memory. And particularly if you go into these things, you know, as I did in the guided meditation, I said, you know, thoughts are going to arise and go and arise and go. They're going to come from nothing, they're going to go from nothing, and they leave no residua. So why hang on to them? You know, and so it may either at the end of a meditation period, you may feel like you've been asleep because you have no memory for what you just did. And yet if I were to record your EEG during that period of time, you actually were awake for much of it. So I'm not sure about the hypnosis piece and how that weaves in, but I think there is something there. Yeah. Yeah.
One more.
Have there been any studies on a visual artist's mental states when they're in the process of making art, of say painting? I ask this because what we just did, you know, the state, the experience, and what I've experienced sometimes in meditation, but having you kind of, you know, take us through it was even, I was more conscious of it. I've experienced that more intensely painting than probably than even meditating. And I'm curious, have there been any studies comparing the mental states of visual artists to like meditative states? And certainly in terms of mystical transport.
I would defer to a lot of other people in the room, but probably no more than I, but I would say what this partakes of for me is the concept of flow. The idea of being in the moment, which is very much a part of meditative practice, of being in the flow of the moment, is true for multiplicity of human activities, not just from the visual arts, but you know, performance art and music, sports. Running was talked about earlier today. I think you talked about the puzzles and mental concentration aspects. There's that piece where I think you're in the moment, and that allows the creative novel insight to show up. That becomes the perfect brushstroke that takes the painting from something mundane to something magnificent. And the alteration in just the right fingering on the bowstring that takes you from a mundane concerto to something that just strikes the hearts of everybody in the audience, that kind of thing.
Okay, so what we thought we could do at this point is to take a break, and then when we come back by 3. Really, really tip into the deep end of the pool as best we can here in a day-long workshop. So if you could, keep nourishing whatever collectedness of mind you've developed at this point, and we'll come back at 3 o'clock. And if you haven't yet signed up for any of the lists, this would be a good time to do.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.